Welcome to The Point. I'm Indy Todd. Today, we discuss the psychology of implicit bias. With us this morning is psychiatrist Mark Whaley. Good morning.
Good morning, Mindy.
Psychiatrist Jonathan Schwartz. Good morning to you.
Good morning. I'm working on the video.
Oh, no worries. And social worker Ann Gagan. Hi, Ann.
Good morning.
So implicit bias is not something we do consciously, right? So who wants to take on how we define implicit bias?
I'll give a start. It's based on how the brain works. So you have to understand how the brain works to understand what implicit bias is, actually. Well, first off, just in terms of the word, implicit means given, kind of hidden, not explicit. It's the opposite of explicit, which is out there in the open and transparent. Implicit is under the covers. It happens. And then bias, of course, is a tendency to believe, value certain ideas or people or things that are just basically more valuable to you, because we always kind of have a hierarchy of things that are valuable and rewarding versus things that are negative and painful. So implicit bias refers to the process of making a decision that is actually biased toward a given outcome that's not based, not N-O-T, based on your weighing the pros and cons of the details of the decision. You're making a decision based on actually emotion. And that's how our brain is wired. If you look at how evolution has worked, most of the millions of years of evolution have been devoted, basically, toward of life, I'm talking about life in general, have been devoted toward perfecting survival and not toward what we experience life as in terms of conscious appreciation. Other animals don't have the degree of consciousness that we have or the complexity of it. And most of the years of evolution was spent just developing survival techniques, survival means of running or getting away, avoiding danger and approaching reward. So our brains are wired to filter everything that comes into our brain, all the senses that feed information into the brain, the five senses. It first is comes through a part of the brain that is unconscious. We're not aware of it. And it's processed there first, and it's given a kind of a value of good or bad, threat or not threat, reward or non-reward, automatically. That's the way our perceptions work. Actually, it's the way all senses work. The information is first filtered through this hidden layer that's below our consciousness. So once it arrives to our consciousness, it already has a value placed on it. And the value that gets placed is based on our previous experience and genetics, actually, genetic transmission, because there's some things that were just genetically inherited or is genetically inherited and passed on for us to react to and be biased, basically, in a certain way. For instance, spiders might be one of them. So implicit bias means that a decision that we make comes from our gut, basically. And our gut is absolutely necessary for decisions. And it's also dictated by decisions. Our decisions are dictated by the emotion and the feeling we have in our body. And that's all unconscious. And as you can tell, just by chance, it's going to be biased because everybody's experience is different. So that the things you've learned are varied. And you're going to attach value to information coming in a varied way according to your own experience. And then you get to be conscious of it. then you're aware and you can manipulate the information. You can weigh the pros and cons, and you can decide how to react. But basically, we like to say, especially as Americans, we like to think we have free will and we can control our world, we can control our decisions. Well, we really sort of don't. We're limited because the emotional processing comes first, and that's not under our free will control. It's not even accessible to our free will capacities. It just is. So implicit bias is based on this. It's basically based on how the brain works.
I have a real short definition.
Yeah.
thoughts about people you didn't know you had.
Oh, yeah. That's a great way to put it. Thoughts you have about people you didn't know you had. Yeah.
I think, you know, when I read that, I thought, the understanding that we have, and we all have this, everyone has this, because it's again, following up with Mark said, it's our brain has to collect information, and we have to make patterns, and we have to make snap judgments, and we like to shortcut all the processing, so our brain goes really quickly into, elderly person, weak, frail, all these real quick cuts to generalizations, and therefore sometimes behaviors and actions that we don't even know we're doing, because we'd like to think we're so broad-minded.
So this is different than stereotyping. I mean, stereotyping, sometimes we're doing that consciously, right? So this is the unconscious part that we're talking about, right?
Yes. Yeah. It leads to stereotyping. It's the engine behind it, more or less. But yes, stereotyping is more of a conscious control process.
Yeah. Jonathan, what are your thoughts?
Well, I think all of us have done a lot of reading and thinking about the sort of science, the neurology, of implicit bias and the unconsciousness of it. Maybe I'm jumping the gun a little bit, but I find that what intrigues me and what I think is most important for me personally is to figure out practical ways for me to test myself, to come to understand how all of this psychology and physiology results on a day-to-day basis in my own choices, my own behaviors, my own biases. And I'm hoping that Mark, because and Anne too, because they, do a lot of reading, have some tips for the listeners and for me as to how we can get much better at being anti-racist citizens. Because that's really what we're all here to focus on, is how do we become, if we accept, as I do, that we all have grown up in a implicitly and explicitly racist society, how do we get better at being anti-racist? It's great to understand what Mark and Anne are just talking about, and I appreciate that, but I want to get better at this.
I was going to say, and we are going to get to that. So yeah, you're jumping in a little bit, but I think you may be ahead of some people though, Jonathan, in that recognizing, yes, I have bias. I think there are people who say, bias? I don't have any bias. I make decisions based on fact, right? There are people who say, I look at the facts, when we know that isn't how the brain works, right? So I think first we have to get people to recognize that, yes, they do, we all have bias. Yeah.
Yeah, it's part of being alive. Yeah. Part of consciousness.
No question. Yeah.
The way it can be helpful to know this, it can make you a little bit more tolerant of other people, because if you look at somebody who is expressing an idea you consider absolutely bonkers, I keep coming back to it, they support Trump, especially with his performance lately. You can have some appreciation for they are, obviously, they're biased toward some things that Trump represents, and they have reasons for that. They have experiences that have led them to be biased that way, just like I've had experiences, or we've had experiences that lead us to be biased against Trump. We're basically all human. We're all slaves to the way that our brains have been constructed. If we just accept that without judgment, you can start to be a little bit more tolerant of people who express things that are outside your own boundaries. Recognizing it is indeed a first step, and it's not a step that many people take.
And Mark, I think jumping on that is also the idea. We're not bad people because we have implicit bias. We're not bad people. We are human. And this biases are, they come from the brain and they come from conditioning and they come from society. And it's just what we accumulate as we're going through life.
Right.
It's what we're doing now. It's paying attention to A, these implicit biases exist, and B, being curious about them and beginning to work within ourselves and within our communication and our media and our society to say, wait a minute, where did that come from?
Sure.
I think we do it all the time. I mean, I think we can all just take a moment and think, well, when I saw that young guy with pants falling off his backside coming down the street, did I gently kind of walk over to the other side of the sidewalk, or did I? We do stuff. We do behavior all the time, which reinforces, of course, that implicit bias. If I told you that I love youth and I love, I think I'm very generous with young people, that's what I believe. But my behavior is influenced by that implicit bias.
Yeah.
That we've collected over time.
The good news is you do have a choice of whether you act on it each time, if you're aware of where the impulse to go to the other side of the street comes from, what it's based on. You can go to the other side of the street, or you don't have to. You could take a risk. Maybe you don't want to. That's okay. But at least you're aware of a decision that otherwise is just automatically driving you. And I think the other good news is, with the violence against black people that we've can no longer ignore, with some of the incidents, as rare as they might be, being in our face, we can no longer go about life without paying attention to implicit bias and the destructiveness of it, and because the abuse of black people is just so shameful, basically, and so against American ideals. Maybe now we can start the process of what the founding fathers promised, is a society where everybody has an equal opportunity. It's never been that way.
I'm not so sure that the American founders really meant equal opportunity for everyone. I mean, I think we're now looking at some history that has been very surprising to people about how the society was set up to benefit white men in particular. You're listening to The Point. We are talking about the psychology of implicit bias. This morning with us is psychiatrist Mark Whaley, psychiatrist Jonathan Schwartz, and social worker Ann Gagan. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626 if you'd like to join the conversation. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. And John is giving us a call from Orleans. Good morning, John.
Good morning. Question.
Sure.
Mark said that implicit bias is a product of the brain and experience. I think continued inquiry, if one does it, can do away with implicit bias, and therefore that people have free will if they continually inquire. Please comment. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, you're right. The brain is not only producing this, it also is malleable, plastic. You can change things in the brain. But implicit bias, depending on what you're biased about, it's not easy to do that. In other words, inquiry is the first step. And that's what we're urging with this topic today. And it sounds like if you listen to The Hidden Brain this afternoon, you're going to have the same topic,
Similar, yeah.
There. Yeah, so this is a good day for implicit bias on NPR.
John, thanks for the call. Mark, you said something, and I'm kind of playing off of what John was asking. When you were talking about, I was thinking, is implicit bias something learned? And you said it's also genetic. So how much is learned and how much is genetic? Do we know?
It depends on how you look at it. It certainly is both. The information that we tag the value that we tag information that comes in is basically learned information. However, there is some information that is already given. I use spiders as an example because it's so people are usually squeamish around spiders. It's just a given thing, even though they have never been exposed to them to learn anything about them. It just is something that's in our, I think, transmitted genetically, or the propensity is to have an emotional gut reaction that's negative against them. There is definitely an inherited part, just like dogs inherit the urge to scratch after they relieve themselves, as if they're in the wild back there as wolves covering over their tracks, covering over their feces, so that they aren't going to be, another animal's meal. So these things are inherited, these tendencies, behaviors are inherited to some degree. Think about the learning starting at some point, really in the womb, when there's enough brain cells connected to start to process some information. Babies do sense, or infants infants do sense some things. And that's going to have an influence on how their brain gets wired, because that's the active time of wiring. The point about inquiries is very well taken, and whether that results in true free will, we could debate for hours. But if you have the desire to have a in-depth conversation with people, bring that up.
See how the code goes. John, thank you for the phone call. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. And we're talking about the impacts of implicit bias. And when we look at, we've been talking about race a little bit here, of course it goes across all kinds of spectrums, but the implications are bigger than we might imagine. It impacts healthcare, criminal justice, education, employment, housing, really everything across the board.
Yeah.
Well, if you think about, I was thinking about the from the beginning, even from the beginning of the child in the womb, and what we have, and implicit bias is always an inherent protective measure. It's like what threatens me, what doesn't threaten me. And I'm thinking about from the very beginning, in terms of the mother who can't get good health care, or is afraid to get good health care, or economically can't afford it, or doesn't have insurance. And therefore, the disadvantages start beginning. Or the black mother who goes into the clinic, and there's a lot of assumptions that, well, she would never want to have a midwife, or she'd never want to have. There's a lot of assumptions that start beginning from day one, and you walk that child through whether they go to preschool or don't go to preschool, whether they can, you know, get into. What happens in educationally? There's so many studies that black children in the educational system come in with so many disadvantages because the majority of teachers are white. Mm-hmm. But there have been studies that there's always there are preferences for boys and white boys over, you know, white girls and over black boys or black girls. And it just keeps moving through a person's life. It's really hard when you really walk yourself through what happens in many situations with the systemic barriers that come in, and then the people who are delivering the services and what they're carrying within themselves, perhaps unexamined.
Yep. No, that's right. The other thing is one implicit bias is we tend to be biased towards what's familiar. So if something's familiar, we'll give it a higher value as opposed to something that's new and unfamiliar, which can be threatening. Advertising takes advantage of this. They make some products familiar to us by advertising, you know, showing the image, the logos in our face. So when we go into the supermarket, we're going to be drawn unconsciously, again, gut feeling, toward that product when we have a choice to make. Just remember, every choice we make is influenced by our emotional processing that's out of awareness and is biased. Slanted.
Yeah, go ahead, Jonathan.
I would say that in healthcare, we probably generally think of ourselves in the healthcare world as being relatively unbiased in delivering services to people, regardless of who they are and what skin color they have. But it's been shown, really beyond a doubt, that Black Americans get better care from Black physicians than they do from white physicians. They have longer visits. They have more exhaustive conversations. They are attended to better. And although it's not obvious how to fix this in any short-term way, it's another example of how we have implicit biases that color how we treat people, even though consciously we would deny that.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, just thinking back to the comments about advertising and knowing what's familiar leads me to the thought of how much fear and anxiety can drive our decisions, right? And especially like in this time now with the pandemic, you're like, uh-oh. Did I touch my face? And you can that panic can start to take over. You're going, oh, wait, when? And so I guess, and one of the things to do in that situation, I think, Mark, this was some information you sent over, is kind of stop yourself and say, well, wait a minute, when was the last time I washed my hands? And try not to let that panic and fear and it's hard to do. I mean, when you're living in fear and anxiety, it is very hard to step out of that.
Oh, absolutely. Because when you're in fear and anxiety, the part of your brain that's conscious and can plan and can weigh things plus and minus, you know, look at the facts, goes offline. It's not fully functional, so that you're reacting purely by emotion, especially if it's a panic attack. Nothing but emotion, more or less. Nothing logical is driving your behaviors. Logic doesn't come into play because the part that deals with logic, part of the brain, is relatively non-functional for that temporary period of time.
So what do you do? What do you do if you feel like you're in that situation? I mean, there are situations where you can go, okay, I can stop. I can make this decision later. I can think about this. But when you're in a situation like Ann talked about, do I cross the street or do I not cross the street? When you have to make that split decision, how do you try and overcome that fear and panic?
I think just be aware of what's happening in your body and that it's natural. And that you're not going to die of it. You might have an idea that you're going to be overwhelmed and lose control of yourself, but that's part of the alarm system. It's not the fact. So you want to draw yourself back to waking up the front part of your brain, which is focusing on facts, focusing on the here and now. Grounding is one of the things that psychotherapists talk about, doing things that ground you. And sometimes that's exercise. Sometimes that's pinching yourself, something that makes the here and now real to you and draws your attention away from racing mind that is otherwise there, from the roller coaster mind that's dominating. Because you don't have to be there, and you will not die of it. People don't die in panic attacks, unless they have some kind of underlying condition, like a bad heart condition. Their life is going to go on. This is just the alarm bells, like in a fire station, ringing. That's all it is.
Yeah. Anybody else have thoughts on that?
Well, I think sometimes we don't even react emotionally to the biases. I think we just act. I think that there isn't an emotional trigger. It's just this is a person that rings these bells inside of me, and I act really quickly. And I think, again, the awareness is about, yeah, we have these biases, but we have to deal with them, and they're unacceptable. And that's the task that lies ahead of us, is to start learning. And again, we can go through some of the things that are being done that are helping people address this. This issue is not new. This issue has come up again and again. We've had a lot of work with this with police departments, and starting 10 or 15 years ago. But it's still such a problem. And I think one of the things that's happening is we have such overt racism right now, such explicit racism, that it's real easy for those of us that go, oh my God, look at that. That's so awful. How can they think that? How can they do that? How can they say that? That it pushes it away from the personal responsibility of what we do in our little worlds on a day-to-day basis, and our thoughts that flicker through that go, oh, that person, thinks they're full of themselves, or whatever these little thoughts are that come up that are based on really old information, maybe when we were a kid or when we were in school or when we had a seminal experience. Maybe some kid pushed us on the bus, and from that point on, we made assumptions about all the people in our lives that look like that kid. Right. So I think we can get outraged and angry and emotional about explicit stereotypes and racism, and say, that's not me. That's not my belief. I don't believe that. And then forget on the micro level what we may be doing, not only with minorities or Black folks, but with disabled people, with gay and lesbians and trans, all those folks that are our society inherently thinks less than. They don't.
Marginalized, yeah.
Marginalized,
exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know if anybody knows the answer to this, but one of the things I think one of you just brought up, I think it was you, Mark, you brought up the familiarization. Like, we have a tendency to gravitate to what we're... Now, we look at Cape Cod, we're all white. It's a predominantly white area. How, where we don't have that familiarity, how do we get that? How do we encourage that? How do we, become familiar?
Just by exposure, with whatever means you have it to do so, whether that's leaving the Cape, that's a novel idea for some people, or watching media, literature that gives a sense, obviously more than a sense, of other people's experiences. And there's a lot, certainly, in literature about racism these days. Those kind of ways, and just thinking, talking like we are now, and making this a conversation at your dinner table with your kids too, because don't forget, the kids are they lap up things like
learning
this.
From you, yeah.
Yeah, they're learning from you, and they're learning from their peers. So try to make it more explicit in your communications. Just don't. The point is not to ignore it and not to dismiss it because it's uncomfortable.
We have an email from Aaron in Rochester who says, in the context of race, white people need to listen to the people of color who want to tell you what they've been up against. I am a white person. The experience of being black in this country is finally a topic of conversation. How differently you are treated in stores, restaurants, anywhere. If you have black or brown skin, white people need to hear this from the people who've been experiencing it. They've been quietly suffering and stressed because of the bias around them. Thank you for your show and great discussion. And I think that's the key that, you know, feels a little bit different. I think we've all been around through the 1960s and 70s and the civil rights movement, and we thought we made such progress. And I think it's been shocking. I know to me it's been shocking when I look around, really open your eyes and look around at what's happening, how far we have not come, right? Okay. And I feel like the conversations are different this time. I feel like they're, you know, especially some of the young people who are they're really encouraged and really inspired to make change. And of course it's difficult, and it can't come from just, you know, rallies and protests. It's got to come from policy, and I think having these conversations are great. And not all people of color want to share their stories. They've been sharing their stories for so long and reliving these anxieties. So I think it's important we put it out there. We'd love to hear those stories, and we'd love for people who think there's no problem to hear those stories and realize that. But it's a difficult conversations, and it's going to take a lot to really make change.
It's going to take a number of generations.
What I think is most difficult is for us to entertain the notion that we are ourselves, all of us, to some degree, the word victims probably isn't the right word, but victims of implicit bias. I mean, you have to be willing to believe that you have been influenced by implicit bias. There was a meeting in New Bedford of the school committee, I think yesterday, the day before. Interesting. I'm going to quote for you what a member of the school committee said at this open public meeting. I'm not going to name him, but he was upset at the requests/demands that the school resource officers, i.e. policemen, be removed from the schools. And of course, we see this happening all over the country, that school departments are considering doing this. What this man said was, let me be the first to tell you, I am not a racist. I have never been a racist. I'm a police officer. I'm a human being. I have a family just like everyone else who's writing these letters. Now, to me, I don't know this person, never met this person. I'm not going to judge him except to say that the notion that you have a family or that you're a human being or that you're a police officer somehow excludes the possibility or would exclude you from the possibility of having some implicit bias. I mean, we who are here on the show can say that this is absurd. I mean, it's our job as physicians, as healthcare professionals, as police officers, as teachers, as everybody, to at least be open to the possibility that because we've grown up in a racist society, of course we have internalized some of these biases. How could you not do that? But we still have a long way to go.
Yeah, right? For sure. Yeah,
and it's simply that's the way the brain works. The brain works on implicit bias because we go about our life daily making decisions that we don't really have much conscious deliberation about. We just do it. And if you really examine it, there's some bias toward the decisions that you make. If you really, tease out the anatomy of the thoughts, the pattern of thinking, if you can trace it back. By the way, I wanted to put in a special pitch for anybody who wants to really examine themselves, and I hope a lot of people do, that online there's a very easy and interesting and fascinating way to do so. It's run by Harvard, And they have online what's called the Implicit Association Test, IAT, Implicit Association Test. And you can just Google Project Implicit. It would be the easiest way. And there, I had written a an actual link that you can put on the website, Mindy. If you go there and explore it, there's at least 15 different items you can test yourself for about whether you have any implicit bias on these scales, on the items. The 15 items, you do this privately, by the way, and it's not, it's completely anonymous, and it's just for your own enlightenment. But the scales range from how you feel towards transgender or lesbian, gay, how you feel about weight of individuals, how you feel about age, how you feel about skin tone, sexuality, religion, disability, weapons, all the kind of the hot button items, and then some, that you can learn whether you actually have implicit bias. And the way it's done, it's an association test. You just sit in front of the computer, and they flash up things, and they want you to characterize images or words as good and bad, and you do this real fast without thinking. The pattern of your associations can tell whether you have implicit bias on that given subject. It's a little bit like playing a video game. It can be fun. It can also be cumbersome because you're trying to beat the game, so to speak, and not appear biased. And because you have these values about yourself that you prefer not to score, in the biased category. But if you just approach it openly, you can learn some things about yourself, and that can certainly instruct you.
At least get you on the road to thinking, and maybe some surprises there that you didn't know about yourself. You're listening to The Point. We are talking about the psychology of implicit bias with psychiatrist Mark Whaley, psychiatrist Jonathan Schwartz, and social worker Ann Gagan. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. And Mark, you're talking about the Project Implicit at Harvard University, which is really interesting. And I haven't taken all. I took a couple of them. I didn't find any big surprises. I thought I was ready for, oh, I'm going to be really surprised. And I only took a couple, though. I have to go back and take some more. But it is really interesting to go through that process. So the idea, once we find this, we go, oh, my gosh, I didn't realize that, these thoughts were going in my head. The idea, as Anne mentioned earlier, isn't to feel bad about this discovery in ourselves, but to become aware and to check ourselves to see that we're not making judgments on stereotypes or prejudice, right? So how do we do that? Talk about that process.
Well, I'd like to share that one of the programs that seems to be having good effect is run by Patricia Devine at the University of Wisconsin. There are a lot of implicit bias programs, and one of the debates are they haven't really been research based or evaluated effectively, and as a consequence, some of the programs, like at Starbucks and other Silicon Valley places, and even some police departments, have variable effectiveness. But Patricia Devine's program has been validated, and she takes the premise that these implicit biases have formed habits, mental habits, and that we can change our mental habits. And first of all, of course, it takes an awareness, like to say, oh my gosh, I just saw that fat person and was like, there it is. And yeah. I have friends that are heavy set. So you have to have the awareness, and you have to be motivated to change. And that's number two. You can say, oh, well, I'm not really a prejudiced person. I'm not really biased. But let's look behind the scenes here and see what's going on internally. And so once you become aware, then you have to be motivated, and you really, and then you have to have a strategy for changing, a real good strategy. And that's like to look at the stereotypes and replace them, start replacing the stereotypes that we hold in our inside of ourselves. And I think this is the one that I think is the most hopeful. Look for the situational reasons why a person behaves in the way they do. See them as an individual.
Right.
See this person as an individual. So if I go back to my guy coming down the sidewalk and I'm jumping over to the other side and that guy gives me a bad look, he's just walking down the sidewalk.
Mm-hmm.
He's just doing his thing. I'm the one that's cueing a behavioral change in myself and in him.
Right. Yeah.
That's something to look at.
Yeah.
Sure.
Then
exactly.
I'm going to go, oh, he just fit the stereotype because he gave me, you know, a bad look. Well,
yeah.
I did that. And then, you know, look for people outside of your own group. Make a conscious effort. I think in Falmouth, they did a young people of color had a gathering, I think earlier this week, and they just talked about their experience. Show up, find out. And look at it as a habit that can be broken. And I think that's where the neutrality comes in, that we're not like, oh, I'm a terrible person. I have all these. We can't change how all the impressions of our childhood and adolescence and early adulthood and adulthood have affected us. But we can become aware and we can say, this is a bad habit. Whenever I see that type of person, I have this thought and then I act this way.
Yeah.
And so I think it's not making us bad people for this, but it's making us, it's unacceptable. So what am I going to do about it?
Right. Let's talk to Margaret, who's giving us a call from Orleans. Hi, Margaret.
Hi. I am really wondering about this. Assuming that implicit bias, both racism, sexism, and such, was much stronger 200 years ago, how far do we go in forgiving the people who had that bias and yet did great things, and even the people who acted on the bias, such as having slaves?
Mm-hmm.
And that goes with the question of tearing down statues of certain people.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks for the question, Margaret.
It's not simple. I mean, there's no simple pattern answer or one-way answer. But you need to hold on to the fact, as you explained the question, that there is mixed feelings about people's decisions earlier on. And it's just they were responding to their environments at the time, just the way we respond to ours at this time. They're human just like us, they also didn't have the tools, and the science hadn't gotten to the point where looking at the brain and identifying how it works and was a topic of discussion. I mean, they was probably largely the thought was steered around religious themes those years. So they're a product of their time.
I can't think of a better example than Thomas Jefferson, mm-hmm. who was the author of All Men Are Created Equal, and who had dozens, actually hundreds of slaves, fathered numerous children. I can't remember if it was seven or nine children by slaves that he owned, and yet was the author of these documents, which I'm sure he totally believed in. How do we, so should every statue of Thomas Jefferson be torn down? It's complicated, no pun intended, but this is not a matter of black and white.
Yeah,
that's right.
Yeah.
You know, he was doing something that we're all called upon to do, is be better humans.
Yeah.
We can all be better. He kind of struck out of a stereotype, if you will, or a pattern at his time, at least in his writings. And so he was trying to be better, and we can value that. We do value those writings and don't dismiss them just because he didn't live that way.
All right. Margaret, thank you for the phone call. We have a caller calling from the South Coast. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. Yeah, go ahead.
You know, I was born and bred in Massachusetts, but I married a woman Mexican American, mm-hmm. and met in California, moved out here to Massachusetts. But we moved here in 1999, but we've experienced awful racism, nonstop. And like I say, Arthur Ashe, when he said it's a full time job, if you're trying to raise kids, it really is, And I never had any problems as a white person with racism until I married into it and started, bringing up kids who are, look a little different.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for calling. And I think that's part of it goes back to the email we had earlier. As white people, we need to listen to this, because as white people, we're not experiencing this and we're not seeing this. And because we may not be experiencing that, seeing it doesn't mean it doesn't exist. And I think that's part of the problem. We have people who say this doesn't exist when clearly it does. We've got an email from Marcia in Cumaquid who said, I learned a lesson when bringing a dear friend to get her new car insured. First, we went to the white male insurance agent. He kept talking to me rather than his customer, a dear African master student friend. I literally turned my body toward her so he couldn't speak to me but to her. Then we went to the registry of vehicles, where we waited and waited, seeing one white female agent at the desk in a lively conversation with a client. As we approached her desk, her face went rude and was so drastically unkind while serving us that we left the building. My dear friend wept. I was furious. This was a public employee. I was never so embarrassed to be a member of our society.
Yeah.
So we've got just a couple minutes left. Some final thoughts? Who wants to start? Anne?
Well, I wanted to say one thing that neuroscience is paying attention to that is a good tool to think of. There is a phenomenon called the feeling of certainty. Generated in our brain, in the unconscious part of our brain, where we are just certain of something. One common example, you can't think of an answer, but you know it. That's mm-hmm. the feeling of certainty. You know it. Another example is when you do figure something out and you say, aha, that's it. That's the feeling of certainty. Well, feeling of certainty applies also to implicit biases. We feel certain about our biases and we don't want to question them. And that's real. A neurological phenomenon, the way our brain works. It's somehow this sensation is generated in parts of our brain. There are people that have brain damage in certain parts, and they don't have this feeling of certainty. Mm-hmm. They don't get along very well in life. Just be aware that that's a natural feature of our brain.
And we'll try to put a link up to Project Implicit at our website, capeandislands.org. Anne Gagan, social worker, psychiatrist Jonathan Swartz, psychiatrist Mark Whaley, thank you. We'll talk again next month. Thanks for sharing your thoughts with us this morning.
Thank you.
I'm Indy Todd. Thank you for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.